You're listening to Opus Talks, where you'll be in on conversations with insiders in the energy, chemicals, and environmental commodities markets. Guests share insights into the latest trends and innovations, industry challenges, and much more. Let's dive into the conversations that explore where the energy economy is headed, right here on Opus Talks.
Hello, this is Xavier Cronin, senior editor with Opus's Recycled Plastics Report. We're going to be discussing today why recycling plastic is so complicated with John Youngjohn, who has 30 years experience in plastic recycling and is currently on his own independently based in Cleveland. So thanks a lot for being with us today, John.
I'm thrilled to be part of the process here to help explain the recycling and how it differs from what people's expectations are at home.
Yeah, so jumping right in, why is recycling plastic to the average person who may not know anything other than this plastic Coke bottle goes into my recycling dumpster? How is it actually recycled or not recycled, all the way up to complicated medical plastic and all these other types of plastic? So why is recycling plastic so complicated? And what should the average resident who puts recyclables into a dumpster for collection each week know about what actually happens to this stuff?
Well, that's a question that has about 75 different answers, but let me start with the most basic things in recycling. And we'll start from the consumer whose home has a recycling bin, either under the sink or in his garage. You see the numbers on almost every plastic part that you use at home, and they're identify which are recyclable and which aren't. The problem you have when this material gets put into your bin and gets picked up by your local MRF, which is a municipal recycling facility. They're the ones that take all these plastic pieces, they sort them, they do a little bit of sorting, they bale them, cover those bales in some sort of a strapping type material, and they typically weigh about a ton. The process of sorting is very difficult. And you can imagine with everything that you put in that bin, it's commingled. It's every kind of plastic. And not only is it every different kind of plastic, many of the parts contain multiple different kinds of plastics that are not compatible to recycle together. In fact, they're not compatible to even melt together in some cases. I'll give you a perfect example. Polypropylene is a very difficult resin to recycle in the post-consumer business, which are with your local MRF or your local waste hauler. And the reason for that is many of the polypropylene parts contain more than just polypropylene. For example, a spray bottle, which you would think is all plastic, is actually linear low density. It's probably got some nylon in it. It's got polypropylene for the cap. And it has normally a spring, a metal spring in it. And it may have a little trigger that's another different resin on top of that. Unless that is taken apart, you're going to get contamination in the polypropylene or polyethylene, which makes it sometimes not recyclable or not usable in its recycled form. There's just one out of 100 different iterations of this. And it goes even so far as to say your local bottle that you have, a water bottle or a Gatorade bottle, those bottles use, everybody says, well, just a bottle. It's just a PET bottle. You're correct. But PET is very particular in what resins it's compatible with. So that bottle that you have might have a label on it that's made out of PVC, polyvinyl chloride, not compatible with PET. In fact, it's very detrimental. So when you've got that in a bottle, normally those bottles that you put in your recycle bin may well wind up in the landfill and not recycled at all, which actually costs everyone more money because you're spending time to recycle it. It goes to the MRF that can't recycle it. Then they've got to haul it to a local landfill where it would have been a more advantageous route to just put it in the garbage. I think it's for our recycling on a consumer basis, we need a lot more knowledge and we need a lot more education for the people to understand what's recyclable and what can you do individually to make that stream that you put in your bin more recyclable. For example, I tell my wife almost every day, nope, that's not recyclable. My opinion is that will go to the dump eventually. So what I would suggest is just put it in the regular garbage.
How does she respond, if I may ask?
She said it has, like everyone, it's got a number on the bottom. It's polypropylene. Why can't I put it in? Well, the problem is they won't probably be able to sort that to the point that it's usable. Some cases they can, but it just depends on the part. Somebody who takes a plastic hose and puts it in the garbage bin or the recycle bin, that hose is not recyclable. A lot of things like that that you assume would be are not. Again, it's education more than anything, in my opinion. We've got to do a better job. And when I was in the PET recycling business in Chicago doing post-consumer, I went to visit most of these MRFs. And the MRFs are typically owned by companies like Waste Management and Republic and those kind of places. And they do all the pre-work so that whoever the recycler is who's actually taking all those bales of material and trying to get a recycled, a clean enough product out of that that's usable. And there's probably dozens of iterations of quality within that space where that product could be used at a very low level application. Or if you really do a great job in recycling it, it could be used in a very high level application, say something that's medical or use in food, you know, where it's FDA and you've really gone through this process where you've done the best job possible. Unfortunately, that's the most expensive way. It's the hardest and it's probably the least available.
Is this the reason why the U.S., depending on whose data you look at, is considered a laggard when it comes to recycling plastic compared to take Europe's leader in recycling plastic, Germany? And then if you include all 27 EU countries plus the UK, in general, there's some exceptions. Why is it that the US, yes, we're larger collectively, though, with the EU about a half billion people, and we're, 330 million people. Why can't the US, you mentioned education, but is it really that complicated culturally, or you have any perspective on that?
I have two things that I think are the major reasons. Number one is the size of the United States geographically. Look at how hard it is to get material from one place to another here. It is nothing like Europe. You can get across Europe in 3 hours, 4 hours and be a car. You got a 35 hour car trip to go from New York City to LA. So it makes it more difficult in that respect. And the other thing is, I would say you lived in Europe. My daughter lives in France right now. And we don't do the same job in recycling. They have a bin. Their recycling gets picked up almost every day in Paris. They have to take their material to compost. They've got recycling material. They do a better job in sorting, pre-sorting the recycled material. We put everything in one bin. There are some MRFs and some waste facilities that are calling it dirty recycling. They take everything and don't even require a bin for recycling. And they're trying to clean up what you're putting in with coffee grounds and food from your refrigerator and meat and all sorts of weird stuff that you're trying to clean up. I think that makes it tougher too. I don't see that happening in Europe.
So in terms of the education, I mean, these are excellent points, the size of the U.S. And also you mentioned single stream. To me, it's so clear whose great idea, I'm being sarcastic, whose great idea was single stream recycling? And this is maybe a question that goes back to the 1980s when suddenly it became not all the U.S., like the Pacific Northwest is very green, right? California. But in general, the idea is, you mean to tell me that I've been told for my whole life that I put everything that's supposed to be recycled, cans and metal and cardboard and Amazon packing blocks and plastic bottles, and that all this time, it not all of it, who knows how much of it has actually gotten recycled and how much is, you know, in a landfill in East Podunk, wherever it might be. Doesn't it go back to the idea of that the single stream recycling was fundamentally flawed and is fundamentally flawed. And how are you going to change that?
That's a tough one. And my guess is the single source recycling probably sprung from an idea, somebody in the accounting department, how we can save money. You know, it's a decent idea because it makes it easy for everybody, but it's not the best way to do it. And so rather than spending more money trying to recycle, because generally people don't want to spend more money for a recycled product. When you go to a customer and I've got my small little pellet of recycled polypropylene or recycled PET, you know, that particular customer wants to make sure he's got the highest quality, and he doesn't really want to pay twice as much as prime resin. You know, he wants it to be close to that number. It can be a little bit more expensive. It can be somewhat more, but I think if it's going to be 1.5 times or 2 times the cost, you've killed it. You're gonna have a hard time unless we legislate recycled content. And until we do that, you're probably gonna have the same issue.
I have experience in the Czech Republic. I spent a lot of time there. And outside my apartment complex, it's very simple. These are large dumpsters. There's one for plastic. There's one for glass. There's one for paper. And there's one for metal. And in some cases, they have a couple of others. It's not a big deal. People take their trash out and they self-MRF, so to speak. They basically, how difficult can it, even in the U.S. here, when you go to Starbucks, recyclables versus trash. I mean, people don't care. They throw stuff wherever. But the point is, culturally, if you're talking about education, what would it take to educate people to separate different types of plastic, metal, Amazon pack? Well, that's plastic, right? Amazon packing blocks, tin cans. I mean, it seems to me like how difficult can this education be when, just from my experience in one European country, it's like, hey, I know what plastic is. I'm going to put it here. I know what metal is. This can. I don't know. It just seems to me like it's a hopeless situation sometimes.
It's only hopeless because people haven't been coached. They haven't been trained and educated. And the other problem we've got is we continue as plastics processors, maybe not the processors, the people who are making the product, whether it's a soda, an energy drink, vitamin water, those types of producers are more interested in having their product pop at the local grocery store, the color or whatever it is about that package. They want it to stand out more than everybody else. So just recently, I believe Coca-Cola just changed their Sprite bottle back to clear. Green bottles in PET are a problem. You can't reuse the green unless you go to a green bottle and have the green separated from the clear. That's just a problem. Why do we need green PET? So, and where that gets used is in strapping. So if you've ever seen strapping is the polypropylene that goes around magazines and boxes and things like that, that's impossible to break unless you cut it with a pair of scissors. That material, when you see it as green, that's from bottles. That's from 7-Up bottles and Sprite bottles. That's the only place it's used. Clear can be used in sheet. It can be used in bottles. It can be used in clothes. It can be used in anything.
So education is the key. And yeah, I hear this having gone to these plastic recycling conferences over the last 10 years. It seems like every year it's pretty much that variation, and money is in some cases, you know, a grant, $500,000 grant. We're going to educate people. But if the current data is to be believed, and it depends where you get your recycling data from, that's a separate discussion, we're still at an aggregate of 10% of all the plastic that is used in the U.S. each year, give or take a percent, right? I mean, you tell me your perspective. 10% is recycled compared to, you know, say 40 to 50% as an average in using the EU. So what more education can be done that's not being done? Is it like Saturday afternoon workshops at the local Grange, you know, at any town USA? Or I don't know. It just seems like the education factor has been in play for decades and the recycling rate is still very low.
I think the problem with education is who owns it. So it's almost the same in whatever we do in our lives. You know, now we know that for children, that education is being done by the government. It's forced on us. We don't really have a choice on that. You know, their expectation is everybody gets educated. Somehow we've got to figure out a way to educate people more effectively in these types of things. And whose responsibility is it? Is it the plastics producers? Is it the, you know, the brands? Is it the MRFs? I don't know what the answer is. I can tell you that, again, not that I love more laws and more legislation, but if we legislated something with recycled content, the education would happen because it would have to.
Yeah, and that's the part of that discussion is extended producer responsibility laws, and it's what, 5 or 6 states now. That's a whole, but that's part of this discussion. But the other issue is, why don't we have a federal plastic recycling law? Because right, we got 50 states, 50 different regs. Although you could argue, if the EU, again, 27 plus the UK, if they're able to recycle much plastic, much more volume than we do, they don't have, I mean, they probably do have some EU-wide regulations, but every country has its own regulations and they're doing it. I know it seems like a lot of different issues here, but what about a national plastic recycling law that covers this issue?
I think that's what's going to ultimately happen. I think the states will continue putting in some sort of registrations or regulations in place to, I guess, legislate some percentage of recycled content. I think once that gets across the majority of the states, it could be passed on a national basis.
Yeah, and you know, it's complicated, and this is extremely interesting. There's so many different aspects to this. I can't thank you enough for your perspective. But what about, to play the devil's advocate, if someone says, look, as long as we're not getting plastic, you know, it's not in the waterways as much as it used to be. There's not as much trash on the highways, at the rest areas, you know, throughout the U.S. than there used to be 10, 20 years ago. So what if we're burying it? Okay, I mean, Waste Management and Republic, all these giant trash companies, they have decades and decades of space at landfills all over the country where someone were to say, look, it's just not working, but at least we're burying it. Is there any relevance to that argument in, when it comes to what seems to be an unsolvable problem, increasing the plastic recycling rate? Hey, at least we're burying it.
I'd have two comments on that. One, we are burying it, and I do not believe that there's enough room to continue the burying plastics forever. And I think a lot of our plastics is going offshore. We've been sending waste plastics offshore for years. And so eventually people are going to stop accepting it, or they're going to charge more than what we can pay or we want to pay. So I think that there's a finite end to that. The other thing that you mentioned, and I remember this myself being an old man, you know, that, you know, during my childhood, it wasn't unusual to see people throw bags of garbage outside, you know, trash, basically, not garbage, but trash from whatever they had in their car, throw them outside the window, cigarette butts, whatever it happens to be, cans, bottles, cups. We don't do that. And why? We're better educated, and there's some laws in place for littering. And when that took effect, eventually, it took time, but eventually the littering is way less than what it used to be 30, 40, 50 years ago.
You know, that is such an excellent point. I mean, it's so obvious, right? Being a fellow old man, what was the TV commercial with the Native American crying? But that was more than 30 years ago. I mean, that's the early 70s. Right?
But it takes time. And I would say that probably since the 90s, you know, you see somebody throwing something out of their car, there's a sense of irritation. I get mad. I mean, there's people now, if somebody's parked and they throw something out, they go up, put it back in the guy's car. Yeah. So people are upset when you see somebody throw something out the window. We need to be that way with plastic. When you see somebody throwing away a jar or a PET bottle, why would you throw that in the garbage? You are a lazy son of a gun.
Or they'll say, what option do I have? I'm at the mini mart and it says there's a garbage can here. I'm not doing anything wrong. I just finished my Mountain Dew and and what do you want me to do with it? Put it in my trunk? What would you say to like the average Joe who say, hey, don't get on my case. There's no place. What do you mean recycle it? Garbage is garbage.
That's probably similar to the people who have deposit laws for bottles. You know, if you're someplace at home, you're going to save them and take them back to the store. If you're someplace in the middle of nowhere, you're probably going to throw it out. You've still reduced the number of bottles going into the landfills.
No, but I think the bottom line, you're right. I mean, I don't know who gets actually fined for littering. I'm sure, you know, since the laws went into effect, wherever they might be, I'm sure there's thousands of instances, but in general, I mean, it's an excellent point. People, you just don't see as much trash as you used to, or people littering, and it's an actual penalty. There is no penalty. You could probably find examples, right, of people in certain municipalities seeing people put recyclables in their trash and then getting a ticket, right? I mean, you tell me how often that is. But beside that, there's no penalty for not recycling plastic.
Well, how about, I mean, I remember back in the 90s, early 90s, I lived in New York State in Albany, and the bottle laws had just gone into, you know, the deposit laws had gone into effect. I happened to be a beer drinker at the time, and I remember I was too lazy to take my bottles in, and they would not pick up my trash. My trash bag stayed at the end of my driveway because when the guy picked it up, he heard the bottles, he put it back down.
You don't have to say you were lazy.
Guess what I did the next day? I took the bottles out and I took them to the store to get my money back.
Well, yeah, again, you know, there's so much to talk about. We're probably running out of time, but just to completely switch gears, just to give a real life example of a large plant that recycles plastic waste. You know, I'm talking about PureCycle. This is a publicly traded company that has a market capitalization of about $1 billion. They went public about 7 or 8 years ago. All they do, it's not just plastic, it's specifically polypropylene, but I'll let you explain that. But the reason it's important, it's a plant, it's a former Dow Chemical plant. It was actually demolished, but they used the same land right on the Ohio River in Ironton, Ohio, at the intersection of the three states there. But all this company does is take in they just take in polypropylene scrap and then they produce little pellets. Can you just give an example of how that process works, where it gets from, say, a yogurt cup that someone puts in their bin to get recycled and ends up at this plant where it gets turned into a little pellet, which will be reused again?
So this goes back to what I talked about with the contamination in streams of recycled plastics. In order to do polypropylene is one of the resins as big as it is. It's a 17 billion pound market in North America. And the amount of recycling that's done is way less than 10% on that, I believe. And so I would say that someone like PureCycle is trying to develop a way to recycle polypropylene, because physically recycling polypropylene by sorting, washing, grinding, and remaking it into a pellet, no matter how good you are on a mechanical recycling type application, you're going to get some percentage of that pellet that's not polypropylene. And depending on whether that's 1, 2, 3% or 10% limits where you can sell it. So what we're seeing is PureCycle's one of the newer companies that's trying to do chemical recycling. And there's a whole bunch of ways you can recycle it back to basically a resin precursor, which gives you energy activity. So you could sell that to somebody to run a plant. You could, instead of gas, natural gas, you could sell them this material. It's called pie gas. But somebody like PureCycle is taking those polypropylene pieces from the MRFs and from mostly post-consumer. They're running it through a reactor that strips out everything except the polypropylene. This is their magic things that they do behind the scenes with their activity. So they take these parts and they melt them down. They inject that melted material into a reactor with some sort of a solvent system. And they're stripping everything out of that polypropylene except the actual polypropylene molecule. So when it comes out, in theory, that is as close to 100% polypropylene as you can get from whether it's either chemical or mechanical recycling. You would not get that kind of purity in mechanical recycling, but it's a very expensive process. So that particular process is going to produce a pellet that's more expensive than a prime polypropylene.
Is this an example that would give you reason to be optimistic? It sort of leads into my final question. It's what, 5 or 6 years they've been operating there. They've planned a half billion dollar plant, similar plant, but much larger in Augusta, Georgia. You know, they're talking about plants in Belgium, in Europe, and somewhere in Asia. Like, this is going to be revolutionary. And again, they're one of the few publicly traded, purely plastic recycling companies. That's all they do. And they're publicly traded. You could argue the large petrochemical companies, the Exxons, all the other big petrochemical companies, they have their own recycling projects, but they're part of the larger portfolio. I mean, these are the largest energy companies in the world. PureCycle is all polypropylene all the time, and it's obviously U.S.-based. Are you optimistic in the aftermath of that they actually got the plant up and running? I mean, will we see more PureCycles?
I think that there's the technology in chemical recycling, that whether you take it back to polypropylene or polyethylene or PET or just a product that you can use to support energy needs at a plant. So, for example, people like Exxon, I believe, and some of the other plants, they're taking plastic as a mixed stream and just basically getting energy units out of it. PureCycle is doing something completely different. I think that this is probably the future of what we're going to see in recycling, and it's going to be a mix. People kind of, I don't know, downplay or poo-poo post-industrial recycling, but there's there's a lot more post-industrial recycling going on than post-consumer. And that happens kind of with nobody knowing how much we do. Nobody's measuring that. They're not really capturing those numbers to speak of, but there's quite a bit of recycling going on there. The PureCycle guys are early on, and I think that 5 years down the road, I think our entire recycling streams will be different than what they are today.
But you mentioned we have to get into a clarification of what post-industrial, you just mentioned it in passing, and again, for folks who know nothing about the industry, when you say post-industrial, we've been talking about post-consumer or post-use, like the bottle, you just drank a bottle of Coke, and that's post-consumer. What do you mean by post-industrial plastic waste?
Post-industrial plastic waste would be, there's a facility, a compounding facility, for example, where my past job, where we did polypropylene and some PET, and that facility would take their raw materials from other molders and people who were processing whatever kind of plastic pellet into parts, and they have some scrap left over, whether it's the sprues or parts that didn't meet the specifications or whatever it happens to be, that old material, that I would buy those types of materials and we would clean those up. We would test them. We would run that material through an extruder and add material to it or add sometimes we would add a nucleator, sometimes we'd add an impact modifier, anti-stat, whatever it happened to be. And we would come up with a compounded product that would meet some specification for an end customer who didn't necessarily need post-consumer, but he wanted a recycled product. They got a recycled product. They could buy it at a reasonable price, usually less than prime, or right around the prime price, somewhat less. And they could at least tell their customers, yes, we're using recycled product. post-industrial, but it's still recycled. It's still preventing that product from going into a landfill.
What would be an example of one of these products that you would make for one of your customers back at the compounding shop?
Well, kind of a lower end application, but it's everybody buys them. Those black with a yellow top, there are black totes that you see in all the hardware stores. And they, I don't know how many millions of those they make every week, but there's a lot of those made. And that's a big application for it. Anything, typically a post-industrial application is not normally natural in color. It's usually dark because you're mixing a bunch of stuff that people made for somebody. A lot of it could be automotive parts, but a lot of the parts tend to be black or they wind up going black. So the product that we made at that plant was a black polypropylene copolymer. And we could take our feedstocks and make anything from a 5 melt to a 50 melt. We could get isods from 1 to no break. And that's a pretty wide range of products to make where you could solve people's problems in areas that I don't know as a post-consumer product could do, because it wouldn't be 100% post-consumer. In order to fix that polypropylene or polystyrene or whatever it is you've got, sometimes you have to add other things. And by adding them, it's no longer 100%. Maybe that's fine. Maybe you only need 50%, but it does impact where you can go with it.
In this whole conversation, this underscores as good as anything that the complexity. I mean, you just mentioned, people might say, what's an isod? what's a melt? Melt? Who's melting? Whatever. I mean, I'm not accepting the fact that a lot of people know a lot more than I think they do in terms of these type of processes. But on this particular level, can you just for a minute talk about, we had talked, I don't know, a few years ago about like the rejected soft drink cups. Can you talk at all about, in that case, it was post-industrial, but these are actual cups that had been made, but for some reason, they say, oh my Lord, we can't send them to the fast food chain because they have the wrong information on the cup itself. Can you talk about that type of post-industrial plastic scrap?
Sure. So in the past, I sometimes would buy material from somebody who was a processor, maybe a big company that made yogurt cups, say. And those yogurt cups were printed, and they were printed in error. There was something wrong on the printing. They might have 5 truckloads of those cups before somebody realized there was a problem. And so they can't use them. They'd either have to put a paper label over them, which now makes them unrecyclable, or they just send them to someone like what I was working, where we could grind those up. We had maybe 4 truckloads of cups, yogurt cups that we had, and those cups would be very consistent in the material, and we would know that that would be a premium raw material to use for a better product. It's not post-consumer, although there's a lot of people that would say post-consumer. I considered that post-industrial because it never was in anyone's hands other than the molder.
But the fact that there would even be people saying, no, that's post-consumer, that's all.
People know. It was sold to me as post-consumer. There's no legislation. There is some things like in Europe, you have to go through a whole process to prove that you've got 30% post-consumer. You have to go back to prove where you got the feedstocks. You have to show that they were managed correctly within your plant. We don't have those types of things. In most of North America, they're not normally there. We haven't gotten to that point yet. That's another reason why Europe is probably further along than we are.
So the people who would say, no, that's post-consumer, they would be saying that out of self-interest to get a different price at whatever level.
Higher price.
Right. So in other words, it's not really about, well, we know that they never came out of the plant, but the fact that they were produced by default makes them post-consumer?
It's a gray area. I don't know. It would be like, I always talk to people about going to a lawyer. You never get a black and white answer from a lawyer. I would say in this case, you're never going to get a black and white answer. It depends who you talk to. Somebody's going to say it's post-consumer. Somebody will say it's post-industrial. Since there's not a definition by law, I know in my head which is right. So I sold it as post-industrial.
When is a yogurt cup not a yogurt cup?
when you grind it up and make it into pre-grind. No, I mean,
but in this real life situation, all basically when you were selling it, saying, "Hey, I got," and it was in regrind form, right?
It was in the parts. I think when I bought them, they were parts. They were the actual yogurt cup, you know, a kind of a yogurt cup or a container. I don't want to say it was exactly what it was. It was a container.
When you sold it after you processed it, when you turned it into flake or pellet, you based your price just on the market price? I mean, how did the market define how much you could get for this?
Well, it was a consistent feedstock, so I was able to make it into a higher quality product, and I did get more money for it. Not the same as whether it was post-consumer, but I was able to, you know, get a higher margin based upon a product that was cleaner, and I could do more to it without affecting any of the properties.
So here's a recycling success story, needless to say. Here's these yogurt cups that were printed in Era, and here comes a small recycler like yourself. Hey, I'll buy those. I can turn them into flake or pellet, whatever you did with it. And then this plastic in the form of yogurt cups got transferred or remelted into raw plastic, and that your customers, do you know what they used it to make?
I don't know what that application was off the top of my head. I don't remember. But I believe what I did was I put some sort of an impact modifier like rubber into that, and I sold it as a natural product instead of black because of, well, it was a white. I'm sorry, not natural, but it was a light color, so I didn't have to go black. So that was the reason why we made a little bit more money. Cleaner product. It was easier to impact modify, and it was a light color.
I mean, even again, here's another example of you have to get into the nitty gritty of the technology and the chemistry. Impact modifier. So again, for the uninitiated, what is an impact modifier?
So I'll go back to that little tote that you bought from the Home Depot or wherever you, and somebody in the garage decided it was too far to go get the ladder. I'll turn this tote upside down, stand on it so I can reach up on my shelf. If you have the wrong plastic in there and you don't have an impact modifier to make it strong enough, oops, you fall through the tote, you break your leg. And you're not supposed to stand on them anyway. So I would caution people, do not stand on that tote because there are people who sell recycled product that are probably not telling the truth about what the physical properties are.
So an impact modifier is a substance which is added, in this case, to a plastic raw material in pellet or flake form that makes it stronger. Is that
correct? Correct. Exactly right. It's rubber that just makes it a little less brittle. Think about anything you use at home. If some stuff is bendable, it doesn't break. Some stuff is very inflexible and will snap as soon as you bend it.
Okay, John, are you optimistic that we as a society will recycle more plastic waste over the next decade than we currently are?
Absolutely. I'm going to be part of it. I hope to become another part of a recycling facility or company in the short term here. I'm still interested. I'm ready to go. And I believe in recycling as much as I believe in anything right now for plastics.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed today's insider conversation on Opus Talks. Join us next time for a deep dive into another industry insider's world. You can find more Opus Talks episodes at opusnet.com/podcasts or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.